Podo.
Bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom.
Hello and welcome to the Polling Station. I'm journalist Marie Leconte.
And I am co-founder of Deltapol, Joe Twyman. And this is our last episode before the big day.
Dun, 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 dun.
Football on Sunday. We have, to start, some exclusive polling.
No.
Or should
from a
that
pollster.
Be some exclusive polling?
Oh, God.
See what I did there? Yes, we have polled the nation, or polled the nation, on their pronunciation of the word polling. After much thought amongst us, I can confirm that a majority, a slim majority, 52%.
Oh my God, fucking 52 again.
Exactly. 52% say polling.
Yeah.
31% say polling.
Oh.
And 11% say polling.
Polling. Oh no, but then that's going to, I'm going to get stuck inside my inner head again because I can't remember which one I say.
Yeah, once you start thinking about this, you go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
There may be age and region differences. Haven't been bothered to look at them.
I respect that.
Been very busy.
Yeah, I know, yeah. I feel like we're both very tired. We can apologise to listeners in advance like if, you know, only one in five sentences really makes sense.
It's fine. It's better than Biden. So how was your week?
My week is very good, thank you. I went to Scotland. As someone who loves the heat, I was fucking thrilled to see all of my timeline on Twitter, which is very London heavy, complaining about the heatwave as I was getting rained on in Edinburgh and Livingston and Perth.
I was, I think, hotter than I have ever been in a TV interview.
Congratulations.
Yes, unfortunately, it resulted in a lot of sweat rather than anything else. And this was in Nottingham for the leaders' debates on a courtyard in Nottingham Trent University, which felt like I was being interviewed on the surface of the sun. I, at least, was in shorts and a T-shirt. The poor guy, Nicky Shiller, from BBC News, interviewing me, was in a full suit because, thanks to the unique way the BBC is funded, that's how you have to appear. And he was sweating a lot.
Again, I was wearing sandals in Scotland. My toes got wet.
So let's discuss Scotland.
Well, yeah, this is so I went up because in the great journalistic tradition that, you know, goes back decades and centuries, I went to my editor at some point and I was like, what do we reckon is going on there? Can I go and check it out? And he was like, yeah, sure. So it was really interesting. And obviously, and I think I've got my newsletter in the iNewspaper. You should check it out. And I did caveat it quite heavily. And because I know that candidates will often talk to journalists and say, well, there's no way of knowing, you know, I hope I win. But, you know, they always try to be diplomatic, etc. But I don't think it was that. Like, every candidate I spoke to was genuinely just like, yeah, I have no idea what's going to happen. So in Edinburgh East and Musselburgh, so that's Chris Murray for the Labour Party, who's trying to get the seat from Tommy Tepperd, who's held it for the SNP since 2015. I didn't speak to Tommy, but I did speak to Chris. And he said, you know, obviously we feel like we've done everything we could, but it feels like a coin toss. And then I went the next day to Livingston to speak to Hannah Bardell, the SNP MP, who not that long ago had one of the safest SNP seats in Scotland, even though it used to be before that Robin Cook seat for a very long time. And similarly, she said, you know, the polls are quite close. And Labour actually came third last time with the Tories coming second, but the Tory vote has collapsed there. And it looks like Labour may actually get it. And then the day after that, I went to Perth, to the newly created seat of Perth and Kinrossshire, with a weird hyphen in the middle, which I really hate and resent. Speaking to Luke Graham, who's the Conservative candidate who used to be a Tory MP for a neighbouring constituency before the boundary change. And similarly, I mean, he's trying to unseat Pete Wishart, like one of the, obviously, you know, SNP big dogs. And yeah, same, he's a bit like, may do it, may not. Like, it was a really interesting trip because there was so much more uncertainty. And all the candidates I spoke to as well said a lot of people genuinely seem to be undecided, which we're seeing in the kind of local data, but also even talking to people a week away from the election, quite a lot of people are a bit like, ugh. Partly because independence is no longer such a live wire issue that people will no longer just vote on those lines. Also because I think there's a lot of anger against the SNP and against the Tories. And also because, you know, a lot of people felt betrayed by Labour for quite a long time. So are they ready to come back or not? So it was genuinely, I would say, a very complex picture. I felt a bit bad writing this kind of like big 2000 word long read that ended essentially with, well, all up in the air.
but actually, yeah. I mean, that is the only valid conclusion. There's been a lot of talk and discussion about how much polling there has been in this general election, which is true, and we're going to soar past any previous records for the number of polls conducted this period. And yet, Vanishingly few have been conducted in Scotland and Scotland alone. Mm. Obviously, the national polls include Scotland, but it's a small percentage and you can't read much into the breaks in those polls.
Because I will say, I think speaking to Scottish people, real-life Scottish people, quite often in the polls in the MRPs that have come out, a lot of them have singled out seats and going, no, that's obviously not going to happen. Like, no, that's wrong, that's not, that doesn't smell right at all.
A lot of MRPs don't even take account of Scotland and its obviously hugely different political system.
Yeah.
We ignore Northern Ireland completely and we'll continue to do so on this podcast. But Scotland is in many ways a very similar sort of outlier in terms of the way that people behave in the important issues. Although in Scotland the parties are the same, the motivation for voting is very different.
Yes.
And so it has to be considered differently, and yet isn't.
I always find it really interesting meeting Scottish Tories because they're basically just Lib Dems, like, let's be honest. Like, you know, and especially I think as the Tories in England have gone further and further right, you still have, the kind of Tory candidates who are a bit like... Yeah, I mean, Cameron's all right, wasn't he? Like, you know, it's a bit, like, broadly speaking, like, they usually tend to care a lot about the union, and for whatever reason, they're not left-wing, but aside from that, they're not, you know. And obviously, you have the SNP, which is this massive broadchurch politically, which I think, you know, we've seen across the different leadership contests over there, but I remember especially 2015, when they had that massive intake. You sort of had a bit of everything there. Like, it is ideologically a very weird party, especially now again, and that's something that came up, actually, with every candidate I spoke to, a lot of gnats, and even as in, you know, by which I mean people who would like to see an independent Scotland at some point. I mean, it depends on who you ask, but A, either so pissed off with the SNP and the fact that they feel that, you know, that they've not kind of delivered on what they promised, or because they're not stupid, they can see that independence is not going to happen in the next 5 years, whatever happens. They're essentially getting ready to lend their vote to unionist parties, saying, and to be clear, you know, on the long run, I still very much want Scotland to be independent, but this time round, like, fuck it, I'll vote Labour, I'll vote Tory.
And that's why Scotland is so important in numbers terms. 57 seats, which is, you know, a sizable chunk.
Yeah.
And Labour currently only have 2.
Yes.
So there's big gains to be made there. But the key question that is the unknown going into this election is, what will those type of people that you're describing do? Those people who voted yes for independence in the referendum, who have up until this point voted for the SNP, will they hold their nose and stay voting for the SNP? Will they sit on their hands and just not turn out at all? Or will they lend or indeed move over to one of the unionist parties, presumably Labour, and help Labour make significant gains in seat terms? Because the degree to which those three groups are filled could decide a massive chunk of the electoral picture next time around. For me, it's the Glasgow constituencies that are most interesting.
Well, I went to Edinburgh, so...
I'm more of a Glasgow person myself.
If we're being honest, I prefer Glasgow as well.
What I think is interesting about Glasgow is you have a range of swings there. They're currently all held by the SNP. Glasgow North East, 5% swing to Labour from the SNP, and that goes. Glasgow West, 10% swing from Labour to the SNP, and that goes. And everything else between...
Right.
Could go at some point. So the constituencies to look out for, Glasgow North East and Glasgow West. If Labour don't get North East, then they're in real trouble. If they do get West, then that says a lot about Scotland.
But then, I think there's also so many local issues I find really interesting. So something which had entirely passed me by is that there are, you know, to use the correct professional term, weirdly a shit ton of private schools in Edinburgh. And, you know...
Across Scotland.
So across Scotland, and I think it is the case of both... So in the case of Edinburgh, like, people from out of the city who send their kids there, but also the kids of Edinburgh, I think it's twice more likely to go to private school than the national average. And as a result, I think, you know, the Labour policy of putting VAT on public schools has made, I think, quite a few Labour people quite angsty, because it is kind of coming up as a topic, but also the non-Labour candidates are kind of rubbing their hands with glee and going, everyone keeps talking about it. Generally, it is a topic that people are talking about. So I think you've got that. But then also, I think what I'm looking forward to on election night is... I think we may see even a couple of Tory gains in Scotland and probably nowhere else, which is quite funny. And especially, like, it really was not that long ago that we talked about the fact that the Tories will never win a single seat in Scotland again. You know, Scotland will never be blue. It'll never happen. And they may actually, there are a couple of seats where, again, people are pissed off the SNP, and it's a mix of, even if there's a massive Labour tide kind of across the country, these are not Labour voting people. But also, and I think that's the case in Perth and Kinross-Shire, I think the Tories' hope there is that just about enough people will go, ugh, I don't want to get, vote for the SNP anymore, but I'm still not a fucking Tory, so I guess I'll vote Labour, and then the Tories will kind of like come through the middle. I think it's going to be a funky night for Scotland.
Yeah, and the point is, we simply don't know. And you can poll on this, but even if you do, people are really bad at explaining their own behaviour, and certainly even worse at predicting their behaviour. And I imagine that many people in Scotland will actually make up their mind, even if they don't think they're going to, will make up their mind very close to polling day.
Oh, absolutely. Joe, do you know about Grot?
Grot?
Yes, from 1997.
I was around in 1997, but it doesn't ring a bell.
Grot was Get Rid of Them, which was the first kind of nationally organised tactical voting campaign in Britain. And the way it worked is that they had a list of 20 seats that the Tories could feasibly lose if, you know, traditional Lib Dem voters would lend their votes to Labour and vice versa. And they published that basically in newspapers. They put out lots of ads, etc. And apparently that made some change. So I can tell you making a face, but tactical voting in general in 97 apparently gave the Labour Party between 9 and 14 extra seats and the Liberal Democrats between 10 and 21 extra seats. You're making a face again. And we'll talk about that later. But no, so I think, you know, 97, apparently, according to serious stuff I read, tactical voting kind of came into being. And then my other thing, so the 2001 election, which is perhaps less interesting but funnier, there was a piece in The Guardian in 2001 saying, internet literate voters have at least half a dozen websites giving a breakdown of party strength, some even offering to facilitate a swap of anti-Tory votes. Then noting Riley, the kind of people likely to use the internet are probably already fired up and motivated to vote tactically anyway.
It was a different time back in 2001. In fact, it's funny you should ask, because yes, the first interview I ever did on TV was to discuss internet websites and their and particularly how it links to politics. And so political parties' websites, interviewed by Rita Chakrabarty on the BBC about that.
And
that
paying was subscribers back... will have a link to the video.
That was back in 2001, where it was this sort of strange thing. What I would say is tactical voting is often seen and promoted as this really incredible thing, usually by the people promoting it and who wish to claim importance. But having said all of that, and we'll come on to the numbers behind it, but the reality remains that the margin of victory in some elections can be incredibly small. Let's think about 2017. Theresa May, as we know, failed to get a majority.
Yeah.
But the difference for the Conservatives getting the result they did and getting a working majority was 75 votes.
Oh, that's a really fun fact. I like that.
Now, obviously, those votes have to be apportioned in the right way, in the right constituency.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, 75 votes changes the overall story of that election. Now, a working majority probably wouldn't have been actually that much use.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it changes the overall story. So the margin of these things can be really, really small. And so, yes, maybe in individual instances, tactical voting can make a difference. But actually, when you look at the numbers, it gets more complicated than that.
You're shocking us, tell me, Joe.
Firstly, when you ask people about their views on tactical voting, you find around about sort of 12% of people say that they intend to vote, quote, tactically.
Okay.
You then have another 10-11% who say that they prefer another party, but it has no chance of winning in their constituency. In other words, tactical voting by another name. Combine those together and you get around about a quarter of people, if you're being generous, who are up for tactically voting. But here's where it gets interesting. There's a difference between actually wanting to tactically vote and then voting tactically. Because in order to vote tactically, and if anyone's interested in this, I will be presenting the findings at the Elections Public Opinion and Parties Conference in September, very much the Glastonbury of the political science.
I will be washing
world.
My hair, I'm very sorry.
Anyway, and what we find in the research that we've done is there is a distinction between people having an openness to vote tactically and the information that they have. Only around half of people, 52%, for example, can name who won in their constituency last time. So the most basic bit of information.
Yeah.
Who won in the constituency last time around?
Was in the party or the candidate name?
As in the party.
Oh!
Okay. Only around half of people can name who won in their constituency. Mm. Then fewer than one in five people, around 18%, can name who came first and second in their constituency, which is information that you need. But you also need, of course, to know how close your constituency was last time. And so if you're doing that within 5% bands, only 3% of people can name how close their constituency was broadly and who came first and second.
And I swear to God, this is not me being glib, but like, is it possible that they Googled it the week before and then just forgot immediately afterwards?
Well, this is the thing. That survey was conducted back in October.
Yeah.
We're rerunning the survey.
Ooh. Okay, maybe
just before
September.
Just before the election to see how much information people have now on the new constituencies. So now that some constituencies have changed, in fact, very few haven't changed at all, do they know who's first and second there? Because, of course, the campaigns try to inform you of this and everything else. But then it gets complicated because the standing last time could be very different from how things are now because how the polls have changed. And so you have some campaigns using using data from MRP surveys, which, as we've previously discussed, see previous episodes, are really not good on actual constituency by constituency results, and certainly not on estimates of share of the vote. And so I think there's a real question to be asked about whether those people who say they're tactically voting are actually voting in a tactical way or potentially making the situation worse.
Just vibing it, yeah.
Exactly. Just voting in a way that actually has no real impact on things at all.
So the thing I wonder as well, and I'm not convinced that's something that could be studied, although I suppose that can be my challenge to you, Joe, is, you know, how much when you do look, because I do think, again, so I'm less agnostic, I think, than you are on tactical voting in terms of the results of saying, oh, actually, you know, we can see the shift, you know, convenient shifts happening, you know, in certain areas of the country. But I do wonder how much of it is, let's say, yeah, like there's a, you know, Tories first, Lib Dem close second, Labour distant third in a seat. As a result, the Labour Party may not necessarily campaign all that much in that seat, you know, and will. So there's a lot, and it's definitely not a kind of, you know, definite electoral pact. It's not necessarily done at proper national level. They're not, the Labour Party is not saying, psst, by the way, you should vote for the Lib Dems there. But they may just not use it. But, you know, naturally as well, because even from a self-interested point of view for a political party, they just don't have enough activists to campaign, you know, the same amount in 650 seats, right? So how much of it is as well, it may look like it's tactical voting, like walk and talk like tactical voting, but it's actually happening at party level rather than that voter level?
Precisely. And that's where it's really difficult to entangle things. So obviously, anyone looking at these things wants to avoid correlation being confused with causation. And as I say, certain campaigns in the past to get votes out, to vote tactically, etc., have claimed success when perhaps it wasn't entirely warranted. I think actually the key impact on things is what you're describing. The allocation of scarce resources that parties have being determined by the result last time, and that then leading to what appears to be a tactical vote, but in actual fact is a reflection of Labour knowing they can't win here, the Lib Dems knowing they can't win there, and concentrating on the areas where they have the greatest strength.
I just had one last question, actually. Do we have any information on whether the internet has changed, you know, tactical voting at all? Because it would, you know, I think intellectually it would make sense because so much more information is out there. You can create a campaign much easier. And I think especially social media, you can reach people a lot more effectively. If you're doing, you know, let's say a tactical voting campaign in a certain seat, it's now easier than ever to actually reach out to people. Like, have we seen anything kind of change, let's say between, yeah, like 97, 2001 and maybe 2005, maybe 2010, let's say onwards? Or is that just not something that's been studied?
There are people who've looked into this, but I think it's quite difficult to disentangle all the different things that are going on there. It is certainly true that that since 1997, the development of the internet has meant that people are more easy to contact for these types of campaign. It also means that the information that people have available is far easier. If you want to find out what the result was in your constituency last time, that'll take you 30 seconds on the smartphone that most people carry around most of the time. But even with that, we still have a situation where only 50% of people,
yeah, people just
can say
don't care
who won last time around. And so it's, as you quite rightly say, it's less about the information that people have and more about their willingness and interest in engaging that. And while we've seen information and campaigns rise during the era of the internet, we've also seen apathy, trust, dissatisfaction all impact things in the other direction. Constituency of the Week.
I hate this so much. Like, it's been done without my consent. Ah, why can't you be a smoker? It is insane how much air you have in your lungs.
You're
I don't like it. You're a freak. Go join the circus.
They wouldn't have me. So, this week, we're going to look at the constituency of our friend of the pod, Matthew Warman.
MP for Boston and Skegness.
Is he Matthew or Matt? I've always known him as Matt. So we'll go with that. On paper, very simple result.
But isn't it, because his seat is slightly weird, because I do remember, so when he won in 2015, that was one of the seats UKIP got closest to, or at least during the campaign, it looked like it was going to get very close. Then UKIP kind of disappeared, and I think 2017, 2019, he had these like insane Putin-level majorities.
Yeah, his majority is more than 60%. Mm. So under normal circumstances, you would think, even on the new boundaries, yeah, that's pretty safely safely conservative. But it's also one of the most leave-leaning constituencies in the country.
I believe it's the only constituency in the country that would still vote for Brexit today.
That's based on broad estimates, but I imagine it's probably pretty close to reality. It's definitely Brexit central, which is why UKIP previously have paid such attention to it. And this time around, no less a person than Richard Tice himself is running in the constituency.
Yeah.
Running in the constituency, hoping to make that the second or third constituency for reform on the night. But as you say, we have been here before, and UKIP have consistently posed a challenge and yet have never lived up to the hype. Really interesting question about whether they can do it this time around.
So I will say that Warman probably is weirdly slightly lucky in that when the election was called, and Richard Tice, who was, you might remember, the leader of reform when the election was called, and said, you know, I'm going to run in Boston and Skegness, that's going to be the big thing. That probably, you know, didn't seem great for the Conservatives in Boston. But then obviously Farage famously fucking, you know, came back and was like, surprise, I have returned.
Although the fact that Richard Tice went for Boston and Skegness rather than Clacton was always an indication to me that that Farage wanted to go for Clacton at some stage.
Interesting.
And I saw that as leaving the door open.
The point being that, you know, Farage did come back and said, I'm going to run in Clacton. And I wonder, and I may be entirely wrong, but my first thought then was like, okay, that probably makes it more likely that they'd lose Boston. Well, I guess in that, you know, probably, I suppose one side of the argument is that reform definitely will have a much higher profile nationally with Nigel Farage kind of like being back. But on the other hand, in terms of resources and attention, etc., like more locally, everyone, and I think as we've seen in the press, like everyone's been in Clacton a lot. And also, and again, this is maybe me being a bit of a dick and like quite cynical, but Clacton is so much closer to London than Boston. And so I think that's why if you're a journalist trying to do a piece on like, ooh, what's going to happen, you know, with reform, you're going to do a day trip to Clacton as opposed to, you know, doing the trek to Boston. So I wonder if, yeah, his skin may not weirdly end up being saved by Nigel.
Yeah, it's a really interesting. And ultimately we don't know. UKIP was doing very well in the previous elections when it was challenging for that seat, and yet it didn't win. But in all the elections that Matt Warman's been elected, the Conservatives have won the election. And so this will be different because not only are the Conservatives behind nationally this time, they are behind nationally by some distance. And so what will those former Conservative voters in Boston and Skegness do? I think had Nigel Farage not run in Clacton, the chances would have been better for Richard Tice. But I still think he's in with a shout. But ultimately, we don't know.
It does seem to be, again, and I can't believe we've busy done this, an entire podcast going, ah. But I've tried chatting to, yeah, a few Tories about Boston Skegness, and their response is essentially, no idea. Like, it's not, yeah, it is just very much one of those seats where actually very unclear what's going to happen. So, yeah, well, one to look out for on the night.
It's one of those places where the historical data is of little use. There is no historical precedent for the exact situation, and there is no decent constituency-level polling. Mm. So we can speculate, something we enjoy doing.
We do.
But actually, nobody knows. Mm. So as our constituency of the week, I think it's definitely one to watch on Thursday night. And so now we come to it. This is our final episode before the election. Mm. Marie, what are you doing on election night?
I'm so glad you've asked, because I am very, very pleased with myself. Well, election day, so I'm working on Thursday morning. I'm going to have lunch. Then I'm going to have a disco nap of approximately 2 hours, currently looking between 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. Then I'm going to have a bath. Then I'm going to have dinner. Then I am speaking, actually, and I believe there'll be links to the Zoom live if anyone wants to watch it, but I'm doing a panel of reflections on the election campaign for King's College London. It finishes at 9:15 p.m., at which point I will run out physically as far as my little legs can carry me, and I will go to a party to see some friends. I would say around sort of, you know, between 9:45 and 9:50, I will start drinking. And then I intend to stop drinking at some point between 7 and 8 a.m.
Well, that's certainly something to look forward to.
Yeah, and I'm not working on Friday. So, yeah, if you want to do a 7 a.m. podcast when I've been drinking for sort of like 10 hours, that is an option that's on the table.
Well, maybe for you, but not for me. On the day of the election, everyone at Delta Poll goes into a sort of cocoon, if you like. Not all at the same time. Yeah. That would be weird. But none of us make any kind
of... The Delta Pool cuddle puddle.
None of us make any kind of comment publicly or on social media or anything for fear that it could be interpreted as reporting on the reporting on how people have voted, which is, of course, illegal, but didn't stop one pollster in their inexperience publishing results of how people voted just this week. So instead, I will be attempting to get as much rest as I can before going down to LBC to do their through-the-night election programme. I will be there with Andrew Marr, Sheila Fogarty, and the great Natasha Clark for 10 o'clock when the exit poll hits. And then after that, I will basically be attempting to explain why whether each result that comes in either confirms or denies what the exit poll is showing us, and suggesting to various people things that they can eat in order to placate themselves for the result of that exit poll. Alternatively, of course, if it shows Rishi Sunak surging to a surprise victory, I'll be hiding in the toilets for the entire show. So certainly something to look out for. And by 7 a.m., I will be in no fit state to do any kind of podcast, I'm afraid. But
fine.
But there will,
this is
of course,
why you have to drink.
But there will be a wrap up next week. So there listen out for it. That was The Polling Station. Please like and leave a review. It helps other people find the podcast. We'll be back next week.